This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World, by the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, with Douglas Abrams. Read for you by Douglas Abrams, Francois Chow, and Peter Francis James.
The Invitation to Joy. To celebrate one of our special birthdays, we met for a week in Dharamsala to enjoy our friendship and to create something that we hope will be a birthday gift for others. There is perhaps nothing more joyous than birth, and yet so much of life is spent in sadness, stress, and suffering. We hope this small book will be an invitation to more joy and more happiness.
No dark fate determines the future. We do. Each day and each moment, we are able to create and recreate our lives and the very quality of human life on our planet. This is the power we wield. Lasting happiness cannot be found in pursuit of any goal or achievement. It does not reside in fortune or fame. It resides only in the human mind and heart, and it is here that we hope you will find it.
Our co-writer, Douglas Abrams, has kindly agreed to assist us in this project and interviewed us over the course of a week in Dharamsala. We have asked him to weave our voices together and offer his own as our narrator so that we can share not only our views and our experiences, but also what scientists and others have found to be the wellsprings of joy.
You don't need to believe us. Indeed, nothing we say should be taken as an article of faith. We are sharing what two friends from very different worlds have witnessed and learned in our long lives. We hope you will discover whether what is included here is true by applying it in your own life. Every day is a new opportunity to begin again. Every day is your birthday.
May this book be a blessing for all sentient beings, and for all of God's children, including you. Tenzin Gyatso, His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Emeritus of Southern Africa.
Introduction by Douglas Abrams. As we stepped off the plane at the small airport, the howl of the jet engines deafening and the snow-capped foothills of the Himalayas looming behind us, two old friends embraced. The Archbishop touched the Dalai Lama's cheeks tenderly, and the Dalai Lama pursed his lips as if blowing the Archbishop a kiss. It was a moment of enormous affection and friendship. In the year-long preparations for this visit, we were quite aware of what the meeting might mean for the world, but we never realized what a week together might mean for the two of them. It has been a profound privilege and a daunting responsibility to convey the remarkable week of dialogues that took place in Dharamsala, India, at the Dalai Lama's residence in exile. In this book, I have tried to share with you their intimate conversations, which were filled with seemingly endless laughter and punctuated by many poignant moments of recalling love and loss. Although they had met only a half a dozen times, the men shared a bond that transcended these brief visits, and each considered the other his mischievous spiritual brother. Never before, or likely after, would they have a chance to spend so much time in each other's company, reveling in the joy of their friendship. The heavy footsteps of mortality were never far from our conversations. Our trip itinerary had to be reworked twice so that the Archbishop could attend funerals for his peers. As health and global politics have conspired to keep them apart, we recognized that this might be their last time together. For a week we sat in a pool of soft light, arranged carefully to avoid hurting the Dalai Lama's sensitive eyes, as five video cameras filmed around us. During our quest to understand joy, we explored many of the most profound subjects in life. We were in search of true joy that was not dependent on the vicissitudes of circumstance. We knew that we would need to tackle the obstacles that can so often make joy elusive. During the dialogues, they outlined eight pillars of joy, four pillars of the mind, and four pillars of the heart. These two great leaders agreed on the most important principles, and offered illuminating differences as we attempted to gather insights that might help listeners to find lasting happiness in an ever-changing and often aching world. We had an opportunity each day to sip warm Darjeeling tea and to break bread, Tibetan flatbread. All who were working on filming the interviews were invited to join these daily teas and lunches. One exceptional morning, the Dalai Lama even introduced the Archbishop to his meditation practice in his private residence, and the Archbishop gave the Dalai Lama communion, a rite generally reserved for those who are within the Christian faith. Finally, at the end of the week, we celebrated the Dalai Lama's birthday at the Tibetan Children's Village, one of the boarding schools for children who have fled Tibet, where the Chinese authorities have prevented them from receiving an education based on Tibetan culture and language. The children are sent by their parents over the mountain passes with guides who promise to deliver them to one of the Dalai Lama's schools. It is hard to imagine the heartbreak of parents sending their children away, knowing that they will not see them again for more than a decade, if ever. In the midst of this traumatized school, more than 2,000 students and their teachers cheered as the Dalai Lama, who is prohibited by his monastic vows from dancing, took his first tentative shimmy, encouraged by the Archbishop's irrepressible boogie. The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop are two of the great spiritual masters of our time, but they are also moral leaders who transcend their own traditions and speak always from a concern for humanity as a whole. Their courage and resilience and dogged hope in humanity inspire millions as they refuse to give in to the fashionable cynicism that risks engulfing us. Their joy is clearly not easy or superficial, but one burnished by the fire of adversity, oppression, and struggle. The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop remind us that joy is, in fact, our birthright, and even more fundamental than happiness. Joy, as the Archbishop said during the week, is much bigger than happiness. While happiness is often seen as being dependent on external circumstances, joy is not. This state of mind and heart is much closer to both the Dalai Lama's and the Archbishop's understanding of what animates our lives and what ultimately leads to a life of satisfaction and meaning. The dialogues were about what the Dalai Lama has called the very purpose of life, the goal of avoiding suffering and discovering happiness. They shared their hard-won wisdom of how to live with joy in the face of life's inevitable sorrows. Together, they explored how we can transform joy from an ephemeral state into an enduring trait, from a fleeting feeling into a lasting way of being. From the beginning, this book was envisioned as a three-layer birthday cake. The first layer is the Dalai Lama's and Archbishop Tutu's teachings on joy. Is it really possible to be joyful even in the face of our daily troubles, from frustration with morning traffic to fears of not being able to provide for our families, from anger at those who have wronged us to grief at the loss of those we love, from the ravages of illness to the abyss of death? How do we embrace the reality of our lives, denying nothing, but transcend the pain and suffering that is inescapable? And even when our lives are good, how do we live in joy when so many others are suffering, when crushing poverty robs people of their future, when violence and terror fill our streets, and when ecological devastation endangers the very possibility of life on our planet? This book is an attempt to answer these questions and many more. The second layer is made up of the latest science on joy and also on all the other qualities that they believe are essential for enduring happiness. With new discoveries in brain science and experimental psychology, there are now many profound insights into human flourishing. 2 months before the trip, I had lunch with neuroscientist Richard Davidson, a pioneer researching happiness. He has studied meditators in his lab and found that meditation confers measurable benefits for the brain. We sat at the outdoor table at a Vietnamese restaurant in San Francisco, the ever-present wind blowing the gray-black locks of his boyish haircut. As we ate spring rolls, Davidson said that the Dalai Lama had once confessed to him that he found the science on meditation inspiring, especially when getting out of bed to sit in the early morning. If the science helps the Dalai Lama, it can help the rest of us even more. Too often we see spirituality and science as antagonistic forces, each with its hand at the other's throat. Yet Archbishop Tutu has expressed his belief in the importance of what he calls self-corroborating truth, when many different fields of knowledge point to the same conclusion. Similarly, the Dalai Lama was adamant about the importance of making sure that this was not a Buddhist or a Christian book, but a universal book supported not only by opinion or tradition, but also by science. Full disclosure, I am Jewish, although I also identify as secular. It sounds a little like a joke. A Buddhist, a Christian, and a Jew walk into a bar. The third layer of the birthday cake is the stories of being in Dharamsala with the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop throughout the week. These up-close and personal chapters are meant to allow the listener to join the journey from the first embrace to the final goodbye. We have also included a selection of joy practices at the end of the book. Both teachers shared with us their daily practices, the anchors of their own emotional and spiritual lives. The goal here is not to create a recipe for a joyful life, but to offer some of the techniques and traditions that have served the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop and countless others over the millennia in their respective traditions. These practical exercises will hopefully help you take the teachings, the science, and the stories and incorporate them into your daily life. I have had the privilege of working with many of the great spiritual teachers and scientific pioneers of our time, helping them convey their insights about health and happiness for others. Many of these scientists have generously contributed their research to this book. I'm sure that my fascination, okay, obsession, with joy began while growing up in a loving home that was shadowed by the black dog of depression. Having witnessed and experienced such pain from a very young age, I know that so much of human suffering occurs within our own head and heart. The week in Dharamsala felt like an extraordinary and challenging peak in this lifelong journey to understand both joy and suffering. As the people's ambassador, I sat there for 5 days of interviews, staring into the eyes of two of the most compassionate people on the planet. I am very skeptical about the magical sensations that some attribute to being in the presence of spiritual teachers, but from the very first day, I found my head starting to tingle. It was startling, but perhaps it was simply an example of how my mirror neurons, those special empathic brain cells, were internalizing what I was witnessing in the eyes of these two extremely loving men. Fortunately, I was not alone in the daunting task of distilling their wisdom. Thupten Jinpa, the Dalai Lama's principal translator for more than 30 years and a Buddhist scholar, accompanied me from start to finish. For many years, he was a Buddhist monk, but he gave up his robes for a life of marriage and family in Canada, making him the perfect partner for translating between worlds as well as languages. We sat together during the dialogues, but Jinpa also helped me to prepare the questions and interpret the answers. He's become a trusted collaborator and a dear friend. The questions were not ours alone. We invited the world to ask their questions about joy, and although it turned out we had only 3 days to collect them, we received more than 1,000. It was fascinating that the most asked question was not about how we could discover our own joy, but how we could possibly live with joy in a world filled with so much suffering. During the week, their fingers were often wagging at each other teasingly, moments before their hands were clasped together affectionately. During our first lunch, the Archbishop told the story of a talk they were giving together. As they were getting ready to walk on stage, the Dalai Lama, the world's icon of compassion and peace, pretended to choke his spiritual older brother. The Archbishop turned to the Dalai Lama and said, "Hey, the cameras are on us! Act like a holy man!" These two men remind us that how we choose to act each day is what matters. Even holy men have to act like holy men. But how we think holy men act, serious and severe, pious and reserved, is hardly how these two greet the world or each other. The Archbishop has never claimed sainthood, and the Dalai Lama considers himself a simple monk. They offer us the reflection of real lives filled with pain and turmoil, in the midst of which they have been able to discover a level of peace, of courage, of joy that we can aspire to in our own lives. Their desire for this book is not just to convey their wisdom, but their humanity as well. Suffering is inevitable, they said, but how we respond to that suffering is our choice. Not even oppression or occupation can take away this freedom to choose our response. Right until the very last minute, we did not know if the Archbishop's doctors would allow him to travel. The prostate cancer had returned and was slow this time to respond to treatment. The Archbishop is now on an experimental protocol to see if it will hold the cancer at bay. As we were landing in Dharamsala, what surprised me most was the excitement, anticipation, and perhaps a touch of concern on the Archbishop's face that could be seen in his wide grin and twinkling blue-gray eyes. Day 1, The Nature of True Joy. Arrival. We are fragile creatures.
We are fragile creatures, and it is from this weakness, not despite it, that we discover the possibility of true joy.
I handed the Archbishop his sleek black cane with a silver handle shaped like a greyhound.
Life is filled with challenges and adversity. Fear is inevitable, as is pain, and eventually death. Take the return of the prostate cancer. Well, it does focus the mind.
One of the side effects of the medicine the Archbishop was taking is fatigue, and he had slept for most of the flight to India, a beige blanket pulled up over his head. We had planned to talk on the flight, but sleep was most important, and now he was trying to share his thoughts quickly as we approached Dharamsala. We had stopped off in Amritsar for the night so he could rest and because the airport in Dharamsala was open for only a couple of hours a day. This morning we had visited the famed Harmandir Sahib, the Sikh religion's holiest site. The upper stories are clad in gold, resulting in its popular name, the Golden Temple. There are four doors to get into the Gurdwara, which symbolizes the tradition's openness toward all people and all religions. This seemed like an appropriate place to pay our respects as we were embarking on an interfaith meeting that would bring two of the world's great religions, Christianity and Buddhism, into deep dialogue. As we were swallowed into a throng of the temple's 100,000 daily visitors, we got the call. The Dalai Lama had decided to meet the Archbishop at the airport, a rare honor that he bestows on very few of the endless stream of visiting dignitaries. We were told that he was already on his way. We raced to get out of the temple and back to the airport as we pushed the Archbishop in his wheelchair, his bald head covered by an orange handkerchief, a required sign of respect at the temple, which made him look like a Dayglo pirate. The van tried to inch its way through the traffic-choked streets of Amritsar as a symphony of car horns played. The mass of cars, pedestrians, bicycles, scooters, and animals all jostling for position. Concrete buildings lined the roads, their rebar sticking out in an always unfinished state of expansion. We finally made it to the airport and onto the plane. We wished that the 20-minute flight would go even faster, concerned now that the Dalai Lama would be waiting on the tarmac.
Discovering more joy does not, I'm sorry to say, save us from the inevitability of hardship and heartbreak. In fact, we may cry more easily, but we will laugh more easily too. Perhaps we are just more alive. Yet as we discover more joy, we can face suffering in a way that ennobles rather than embitters. We have hardship without becoming hard. We have heartbreak without being broken.
I had witnessed both the Archbishop's tears and his laughter so many times. Well, more his laughter than his tears, in truth. But he does cry easily and often, for that which is not yet redeemed, for that which is not yet whole. It all matters to him. It all affects him deeply. His prayers, in which I have been enveloped, reach around the world to all who are in need and suffering. One of his book editors had a grandson who was ill, and on the Archbishop's very long daily prayer list. Several years later, the editor asked if he would once again pray for his grandson because the child's illness had returned. The archbishop replied that he had never stopped praying for the boy. From the plane, we could see the snow-covered mountains that are the postcard backdrop to the Dalai Lama's home in exile. After the Chinese invasion of Tibet, the Dalai Lama and 100,000 other Tibetans fled to India. These refugees were temporarily settled in the lowlands of India, where the heat and mosquitoes led a great many to become ill. Eventually, the government of India established the Dalai Lama's residence in Dharamsala, and the Dalai Lama was very grateful for the higher altitude and the cooler weather. Over time, many Tibetans came to settle here as well, as if the community was heartsick for the mountainous landscape and high altitude of their home. And of course, most of all, they wanted to be close to their spiritual and political leader. Dharamsala is in the northern Indian state of Himachal Pradesh, and the British, when they ruled India, also used to come here to escape the relentless heat of the Indian summer. As we approached this former British hill station, we could see the green carpet of pine trees and agricultural fields below. Dense storm clouds and fog often closed the small airport, as it did on my last visit. But today the sky was blue, the wisps of clouds held at bay by the mountains. We descended for the steep landing.
One great question underlies our existence. What is the purpose of life? After much consideration, I believe that the purpose of life is to find happiness. It does not matter whether one is a Buddhist, like me, or a Christian, like the Archbishop, or any other religion, or no religion at all. From the moment of birth, every human being wants to discover happiness and avoid suffering. No differences in our culture, or our education, or our religion affect this. From the very core of our being, we simply desire joy, but so often these feelings are fleeting and hard to find, like a butterfly that lands on us and then flutters away. The ultimate source of happiness is within us, not money, not power, not status. Some of my friends are billionaires, but they're very unhappy people. Power and money fail to bring inner peace. Outward attainment will not bring real inner joyfulness. We must look inside. Sadly, many of the things that undermine our joy and happiness we create ourselves. Often it comes from the negative tendencies of the mind, emotional reactivity, or from our inability to appreciate and utilize the resources that exist within us. The suffering from a natural disaster we cannot control, but the suffering from our daily disasters we can. We create most of our suffering, so it should be logical that we also have the ability to create more joy. It simply depends on the attitudes, the perspectives, and the reactions we bring to situations and to our relationships with other people. When it comes to personal happiness, there is a lot that we as individuals can do.
We lurched forward as the brakes seized the tires, and then the plane rumbled and shook, stopping quickly on the short runway. Out the window of the airplane, we could see the Dalai Lama standing on the tarmac, a large yellow umbrella held over his head to protect him from the bright Indian sun. He was wearing his maroon robe and red shawl, although we could see a small patch of saffron yellow on his sleeveless vest. An entourage of office staff and airport officials in suits flanked him. Indian soldiers in khaki uniforms were providing security. The media had been kept outside of the airport. This was going to be an intimate reunion, with only the Dalai Lama's personal photographer taking pictures. As the Archbishop hobbled down the steep stairs in his blue blazer and signature fisherman's cap, the Dalai Lama approached. The Dalai Lama was smiling, his eyes sparkling behind his large, square-framed glasses. He bowed low, and then the Archbishop spread his arms out, and they embraced. They separated and held each other's shoulders, gazing into each other's eyes, as if trying to convince themselves that they were really together again.
I haven't seen you in a long while.
Archbishop Tutu touched the Dalai Lama's cheeks tenderly with the tips of his fingers and inspected him closely.
You look very good.
The Dalai Lama, still holding the Archbishop's small shoulders, puckered as if to blow him a kiss. The Archbishop raised his left hand, gold wedding ring shining, and clasped the Dalai Lama's chin as one might do to one's precious grandchild. Then the Archbishop went in for a kiss on the cheek. The Dalai Lama, not used to kisses from anyone, flinched, but also laughed with delight, which was quickly accompanied by the Archbishop's high-pitched cackle.
You don't like a kiss?
The Archbishop gave him another on the other cheek. I wondered how many kisses the Dalai Lama had received in his whole life, taken from his parents at age 2, and raised in a rarefied realm, far away from kisses. They stopped for the formal presentation of kata, a white scarf, a Tibetan custom of greeting and respect. The Dalai Lama bowed with hands pressed together at his heart, the gesture of welcome that recognizes our oneness. The Archbishop took off his fisherman's cap and bowed in return. The Dalai Lama then draped the long white silk scarf around the Archbishop's neck. They whispered into each other's ears, trying to talk over the noise of the jet still droning in the background. The Dalai Lama took the Archbishop's hand, and then they were more 8 than 80, laughing and making jokes together as they strolled toward the terminal, yellow umbrella sheltering above them. Even though the Archbishop's white scarf was bunched around his neck, it still hung all the way down his small body. The size of the kata one gives is a sign of the esteem that one holds for the recipient, high lamas receiving the longest ones. This kata was the longest one I had ever seen. The Archbishop joked throughout the week, as kata after kata was draped around his neck, that he felt like a human coat rack. We were ushered into a small room with a couple of brown couches set aside for the Dalai Lama to await his often delayed or canceled flights out of Dharamsala. We could see the media gathered outside the airport, lining the glass wall, waiting for a chance to snap a photograph or ask a question. It was only then that I recalled how newsworthy and even historic this trip was. It had been so easy to get lost in the logistics and to forget that their time together was an important event for the world. In the lounge, the Archbishop relaxed into a couch while the Dalai Lama was perched in a large chair beside him. Next to the Archbishop sat his daughter, Impaw, who was dressed in a brilliant green and red African print dress, her head wrapped with a matching fabric. The youngest of 4 children, she followed her father into the ministry and was now the executive director of the Desmond and Lea Tutu Legacy Foundation. During our trip, Impaw would get down on bended knee and propose to her girlfriend, Marceline Van Firth. The trip was only a couple months before the U.S. Supreme Court made its landmark ruling legalizing gay marriage. But the Archbishop had supported gay rights for decades. He famously had said that he would refuse to go to a homophobic heaven. What many forget, especially those who find themselves on the receiving end of his moral censure, is that the Archbishop decries any form of oppression or discrimination, wherever he might find it. Shortly after the marriage, Impaw was stripped of her ministry because the South African Anglican Church does not recognize gay marriage.
I was really looking forward to coming to your birthday, but your government has some difficulties. At that time, you expressed some very strong words.
The Dalai Lama put his hand on the Archbishop's forearm.
And I appreciated it.
Strong words was an understatement. The week in Dharamsala to celebrate the Dalai Lama's birthday had its origins 4 years earlier, when Archbishop Tutu celebrated his own 80th birthday in Cape Town, South Africa. The Dalai Lama had been invited to be the guest of honor, but the South African government bowed to pressure from the Chinese government and was unwilling to issue the Dalai Lama a visa. China is one of the major buyers of South African minerals and raw materials. The Archbishop was daily on the front page of the South African newspapers leading up to the celebration, railing against the government for their perfidy and duplicity. He even compared the ruling African National Congress, the party whose members he fought for decades to help bring out of exile and imprisonment, to the long-hated apartheid government. He said they were actually worse, because at least in the case of the apartheid government, the villainy was overt.
I always try to avoid any inconvenience, but I was happy someone else was willing to be an inconvenience. I was very happy.
I know. You use me. That's the trouble. You use me, and I don't learn.
The Archbishop then put out his hand and took the Dalai Lama's tenderly.
When the South Africans refused to let you come for my 80th birthday, it made the whole event all the more spectacular, because we had Google hosting our conversation, and there was a lot more press interest than there might have otherwise been. But never mind. Wherever you are, there is a lot of interest. I'm not jealous. You know, I remember when we were in Seattle. They were looking for a venue that would be large enough for the people who wanted to come to see you. And it ended up that they found a football stadium. There were 70,000 people who wanted to come hear this man. And he can't even speak English properly.
The Dalai Lama let out a big belly laugh.
It's really not nice. You really need to pray that I become a little more popular like you.
To tease someone is a sign of intimacy and friendship. To know that there is a reservoir of affection from which we all drink as funny and flawed humans. And yet their jokes were as much about themselves as about each other, never really putting the other down, but constantly reinforcing their bond and their friendship. The Archbishop wanted to thank and introduce each of the people who had helped make the trip possible. He introduced his daughter Impa, philanthropist and peacebuilder Pam Omidyar, and me. But the Dalai Lama said he already knew all of us. Then he introduced my wife Rachel as his American doctor, Pat Christian, a colleague of Pam's from the Omidyar group, and his daughter's soon-to-be fiancée Marceline, a pediatrician and professor of epidemiology in Holland. He did not need to introduce the final member of our party, the Venerable Lama Tenzin Donden, who was a member of the Dalai Lama's own Namgyal Monastery. Now the Dalai Lama was rubbing the Archbishop's hand warmly, as he would throughout the week. They were talking about the flight itinerary and our stopover in Amritsar.
This is very good. Necessary to rest. I always sleep 8 to 9 hours a night.
But you get up very early, don't you?
That's right. 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock?
Always.
And you pray 5 hours?
The Archbishop was holding up 5 fingers for emphasis.
Yes.
The Archbishop looked upward and shook his head.
No, that's too much.
Sometimes I do meditation on the nature of self, using what is known as the sevenfold analysis.
Jinpa later explained that this is a Buddhist contemplative practice in which one searches for the true nature of the self by analyzing the relationship between oneself and the physical and mental aspects of our body and mind.
For example, now, when I look at you and I analyze, I see that this is my dear, respected friend, Bishop Tutu. No, this is his body, not himself. This is his mind, but not himself.
The Dalai Lama leaned in to emphasize his point, presenting a paradoxical riddle as old as Buddhism. He slapped the Archbishop's forearm playfully.
Where is Bishop Tutu's self? We can't find it.
The Archbishop looked a little mystified and a little bemused.
Really?
So now, in quantum physics, they also have a similar view. Any objective thing does not really exist. There is nothing ultimately we can find. This is similar to analytical meditation.
The Archbishop put his hands over his face in bewilderment. The Dalai Lama may have been arguing against there being an essential Bishop Tutu, but at the same time, there was a person, a friend that was special to him in a way that, despite his friendliness to all, was unique and clearly important to him. Jinpa and I discussed what it was about this relationship that probably meant so much. For both of them, it was rare to have a true friend. There are, after all, not many members of the Moral Leaders Club. Their lives are filled with people who relate to them as icons. It must be a relief to find someone who is not looking for a photo op. Certainly, they also share values at a place where the core of all religions meet, and of course they share a fantastic sense of humor. I was beginning to see how central friendship, and relationship more generally, was in our experience of joy. This was a theme that would arise many times in our week together.
I tell people that one of the greatest things about you is your serenity. And I say, well, you know, every day he spends those 5 hours in the morning meditating. And it shows in how you respond to things that are agonizing. The pain of your country and the pain of the world. As I say, I try, but 5 hours is too much.
The Archbishop, characteristically humble and self-effacing, was dismissing his own 3 or 4 hours of prayer a day. It is true he sleeps in. Until 4. What is it, I wondered, about spiritual leaders that they are always getting up early to pray and meditate? It clearly makes a great difference in how they approach their day. When I first heard that the Dalai Lama got up at 3 a.m., I thought I was going to hear another story of superhuman devotion and learn that he slept only 2 or 3 hours a night. I was relieved to hear that he simply went to bed very early, typically by 7 p.m. Not exactly practical for a householder who has children to feed and get to bed, I thought, but perhaps getting to bed an hour earlier and up an hour earlier was possible. Would it lead to more spiritual growth? Would it lead to more joy? The Dalai Lama held the Archbishop's hand up to his cheek.
So now we go to my home.
As we walked out of the airport, the media crowded around the two leaders and shouted questions about the Archbishop's trip. The Archbishop stopped to answer and to use the attention of the media to shine a spotlight on injustice. He spoke as the clicks of cameras peppered his comments.
I am so glad to be with my dear friend. Often things and people try to keep us apart, but the love that we have for each other and the goodness of God's universe ensures that we shall meet. The first time that the South African government refused him a visa when he was going to come to my 80th birthday, I asked him, "How many divisions do you have in your army? Why is China scared of you?" And that is what surprises me. Maybe they are right. A spiritual leader is something that should be taken very seriously. We hope that God's world will become a better place, more hospitable to goodness, more hospitable to compassion, more hospitable to generosity, more hospitable to living together, so we don't have what is happening now between Russia and the Ukraine, or what is happening with ISIS, or what is happening in Kenya or Syria. They make God weep.
The Archbishop turned to leave, but then paused again as another journalist asked about the purpose of his trip.
We are together just to enjoy our friendship and to talk about joy.
The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama were whisked away by a waiting motorcade. The drive to the Dalai Lama's residence was about 3/4 of an hour. The streets had been closed to allow the Dalai Lama to go to the airport, and Tibetans, Indians, and a few tourists were lining the streets, hoping to get a glimpse of him and his special guest. I realize now why the Dalai Lama so rarely makes the pilgrimage to the airport. It is a major logistical operation that shuts down one of the main roads and impacts the whole city. We were here to discuss joy in the face of life's challenges, and everywhere in Dharamsala were reminders that this was a community that had been traumatized by oppression and exile. The town clings to winding hillside roads, and craft stalls hang over the edges of sheer cliffs. Like construction throughout India and so much of the developing world, building codes and security precautions were waved aside to make room for the exploding population. I wondered how these structures would fare in an earthquake and feared that the whole city might be shaken off the back of these mountains like a leaf from a waking animal. The motorcade snaked up as the lines of the devout thickened, some burning incense and many others with mala beads draped around their prayerfully cupped hands. It is hard for non-Tibetans to understand how much the Dalai Lama means to the Tibetan people, and this exile community in particular. He is both the symbol of their national and political identity, and also the embodiment of their spiritual aspirations. To be the embodiment of the Bodhisattva of compassion means in many ways to be a Christ-like figure. I can only imagine how challenging it must be for the Dalai Lama to carry this responsibility while also trying to emphasize his being nothing special, just one of the 7 billion people. The streets narrowed and I wondered how our speeding cars could possibly pass through the throng of people, but we seemed to slow only for the occasional sacred cow that meandered into the street, perhaps also to get a better glimpse of the two holy men. I wondered if the careening pace was due to security concerns or a desire to reopen the roads, but I guessed more likely the former. This city, like all of India's cities, is formed through the constant friction of tectonic layers of culture, shifting and jostling with each other in a vibrant and sometimes uneasy display of devotion and identity. The Tibetan Buddhist hilltop town of McLeod Ganj, known also as Upper Dharamsala, is one more sedimentary level on top of the Hindu Indian city. Dharamsala, or Dharamshala, as it is pronounced in Hindi, means spiritual dwelling, combining the word dharma, or spiritual teaching, with shala, which is a dwelling, and the whole name means pilgrim's lodge, or rest house. It is a fitting name for a city that is the site of so much pilgrimage today. We hurried through the simple metal gates of the Dalai Lama's complex, where his offices and private residence are located. We arrived at a semicircular driveway surrounding a bed bursting with spring flowers. I had visited Dharamsala in January to meet with the Dalai Lama's office to plan this trip. At the time, the whole town was shrouded in clouds and freezing cold, but now the sun was shining brightly, the flowers all the more eager to bloom, as they always seem to be in the brief growing season at higher altitudes. Their lives cut short, every day seemingly more urgent and appreciated. As the beginning of the dialogues grew closer, I realized I was becoming increasingly nervous. But I also knew that I was not the only one. On one of our planning calls for the trip, I had been touched by the Archbishop's honest expression of concern about crossing wits with the Dalai Lama. "He is much more cerebral," he had said, referring to the Dalai Lama's great love of debate, intellectual inquiry, and scientific exploration. "I am more instinctual." I remembered him saying that deep visceral knowing and prayerful surrender had guided all of the major turning points in his life and his mission in the struggle to end apartheid. I guess even great spiritual leaders get nervous when they are journeying into the unknown. After a day of rest for the Archbishop, we would begin the dialogues on the nature of true joy. Why are you not morose? To begin, I invited the Archbishop to offer a prayer, since in his tradition that is the way to open any important conversation.
"Yes, thank you. I always need all the help I can get. Let's be still for a moment. Come, Holy Spirit, fill the hearts of thy faithful people, and kindle in them the fire of thy love. Send forth thy Spirit, and they shall be made new, and thou shalt renew the face of the earth. Amen."
The Dalai Lama added an amen as well. I then asked the Dalai Lama to share his hopes for our time together. He sat back and rubbed his hands.
"Now we are in the 21st century. We are improving on the innovations of the 20th century and continuing to improve our material world. While, of course, there are still a lot of poor people who do not have adequate food, Generally, the world is now highly developed. The problem is that our world and our education remain focused exclusively on external, materialistic values. We are not concerned enough with our inner values. Those who grow up with this kind of education live a materialistic life, and eventually, the whole society becomes materialistic. But this culture is not sufficient to tackle our human problems. The real problem is here.
The Dalai Lama pointed to his head. The Archbishop tapped his chest with his fingers to emphasize the heart as well.
And here, mind and heart. Materialistic values cannot give us peace of mind. So we really need to focus on our inner values, our true humanity. Only this way can we have peace of mind and more peace in our world. A lot of the problems we are facing are our own creation, like war and violence. Unlike a natural disaster, these problems are created by humans ourselves. I feel there is a big contradiction. There are 7 billion human beings, and nobody wants to have problems or suffering. But there are many problems and much suffering, most of our own creation. Why? Something is lacking. As one of the 7 billion human beings, I believe everyone has the responsibility to develop a happier world. We need, ultimately, to have a greater concern for others' well-being. In other words, kindness or compassion, which is lacking now, we must pay more attention to our inner values. We must look inside.
He turned to the Archbishop and raised his hands, palms pressed together, in a gesture of respect.
So now you, Archbishop Tutu, my longtime friend.
He extended his hand to the Archbishop, who took it tenderly between both of his.
I think you have great potential.
Potential?
Great potential, yes. I mean great potential, you see, to create a happier humanity.
Ah, yes.
When people just look at your face, you are always laughing, always joyful. This is a very positive message. Sometimes, when you see political leaders or spiritual leaders, they have very serious face. It makes one hesitant. But when they see your face...
It's the big nose.
So I really appreciate your coming to have this conversation. In order to develop our mind, we must look at a deeper level. Everyone seeks happiness, joyfulness, but from outside, from money, from power, from big car, from big house. Most people never pay much attention to the ultimate source of a happy life, which is inside, not outside. Even the source of physical health is inside, not outside. So there may be a few differences between us. You usually emphasize faith. Personally, I am Buddhist, and I consider faith very important. But at the same time, the reality is that out of 7 billion people, over 1 billion people on the planet are non-believers. So we cannot exclude them. 1 billion is quite a large number. They are also our human brothers and sisters. They also have the right to become happier human beings and to be good members of the human family. So, one need not depend on religious faith to educate our inner values.
It's very difficult to follow your very profound pronouncements. Thought you were going to say that, in fact, when you are pursuing happiness, you are not going to find it. It's very, very elusive. You don't find it by saying, I'm going to forget about everything and just pursue happiness. There's a title of a book by C.S. Lewis called Surprised by Joy, which I think expresses how it works. Many people look at you, and they think of all the awful things that have happened to you. Nothing can be more devastating than being exiled from your home, from the things that are really precious to you. And yet when people come to you, they experience someone who has a wonderful serenity, a wonderful compassion, a mischievousness.
That's the right word. I don't like too much formality.
Don't interrupt me. It's wonderful to discover that what we want is not actually happiness. It is not actually what I would speak of. I would speak of joy. Joy subsumes happiness. Joy is the far greater thing. Think of a mother who is going to give birth. Almost all of us want to escape pain. And mothers know that they are going to have pain, the great pain of giving birth. But they accept it. And even after the most painful labor, once the baby is out, you can't measure the mother's joy. It is one of those incredible things that joy can come so quickly from suffering. A mother can be dead tired from work and all of the things that have worried her. And then her child is ill. That mother will not remember her exhaustion. She can sit at the bedside of her sick child the night through. And when the child gets better, you see that joy.
What is this thing called joy, and how is it possible that it can evoke such a wide range of feelings? How can the experience of joy span from those tears of joy at a birth, to an irrepressible belly laugh at a joke, to a serenely contented smile during meditation? Joy seems to blanket this entire emotional expanse. Paul Ekman, famed emotions researcher and longtime friend of the Dalai Lama, has written that joy is associated with feelings as varied as pleasure of the five senses, amusement from a chuckle to a belly laugh, contentment, a calmer kind of satisfaction, excitement in response to novelty or challenge, relief following upon another emotion, such as fear, anxiety, and even pleasure, wonder before something astonishing and admirable, ecstasy or bliss, transporting us outside ourselves, exultation at having accomplished a difficult or daring task, radiant pride when our children earn a special honor, unhealthy jubilation or Schadenfreude, relishing in someone else's suffering, elevation from having witnessed an act of kindness, generosity, or compassion, and gratitude, the appreciation of a selfless act of which one is the beneficiary. In his book on happiness, Buddhist scholar and former scientist Matthieu Ricard has added three other more exalted states of joy. Rejoicing in someone else's happiness, what Buddhists call mudita, delight or enchantment, a shining kind of contentment, and spiritual radiance, a serene joy born from deep well-being and benevolence. This helpful mapping of the kingdom of joy conveys its complexity and its subtlety. Joy can span from the pleasure of others' good fortune, what Buddhists call mudita, to the pleasure in others' misfortune, what the Germans call Schadenfreude. Clearly, what the Archbishop was describing was more than mere pleasure and closer to the relief, wonder, and ecstasy of birth. Joy certainly does embrace all of these human experiences, but lasting joy, joy is a way of being. That one witnesses in the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama is probably closest to the shining contentment or the spiritual radiance born from deep well-being and benevolence. I knew this complex topography of joy was what we were here to discover. Research conducted at the Institute of Neuroscience and Psychology at the University of Glasgow suggests that there are really only four fundamental emotions, three of which are so-called negative emotions, fear, anger, and sadness. The only positive one is joy or happiness. Exploring joy is nothing less than exploring what makes human experience satisfying. Is joy a feeling that comes and surprises us, or is it a more dependable way of being, I asked. For the two of you, joy seems to be something much more enduring. Your spiritual practice hasn't made you somber and serious, it's made you more joyful. So how can people cultivate that sense of joy as a way of being, and not just a temporary feeling. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama looked at each other, and the Archbishop gestured to the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama squeezed the Archbishop's hand and began.
Yes, it is true. Joy is something different from happiness. When I use the word happiness, in a sense I mean satisfaction. Sometimes we have a painful experience, but that experience, as you've said with birth, can bring great satisfaction and joyfulness.
Let me ask you. You've been in exile 50 what years?
56.
56 years. From a country that you love more than anything else. Why are you not morose?
Morose.
As Jinpa hurried to translate morose into Tibetan, the Archbishop clarified that he meant sad. The Dalai Lama took the Archbishop's hand in his, as if comforting him while reviewing these painful events. The Dalai Lama's storied discovery as the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama meant that at the age of 2 he was swept away from his rural home in the Amdo province of eastern Tibet to the 1,000-room Patala Palace in the capital city of Lhasa. There he was raised in opulent isolation as the future spiritual and political leader of Tibet and as a godlike incarnation of the Bodhisattva of compassion. After the Chinese invasion of Tibet in 1950, the Dalai Lama was thrust into politics. At the age of 15, he found himself the ruler of 6 million people and facing an all-out and desperately unequal war. For 9 years, he tried to negotiate with Communist China for his people's welfare and sought political solutions as the country came to be annexed. In 1959, during an uprising that risked resulting in a massacre, the Dalai Lama decided, with a heavy heart, to go into exile. The odds of successfully escaping to India were frighteningly small. But to avoid a confrontation and a bloodbath, he left in the night dressed as a palace guard. He had to take off his recognizable glasses, and his blurred vision must have heightened his sense of fear and uncertainty as the escape party snuck by garrisons of the People's Liberation Army. They endured sandstorms and snowstorms as they summited 19,000-foot mountain peaks during their 3-week escape.
One of my practices comes from an ancient Indian teacher. He taught that when you experience some tragic situation, think about it. If there's no way to overcome the tragedy, then there is no use worrying too much. So I practice that. This refers to the 8th-century Buddhist master Shantideva, who wrote, "If something can be done about the situation, what need is there for dejection? And if nothing can be done about it, what use is there for being dejected?"
The Archbishop cackled, perhaps because it seemed almost too incredible that someone could stop worrying just because it was pointless.
"Yes, but I think people know it with their head. You know, that it doesn't help worrying. But they still worry. Many of us have become refugees, and there are a lot of difficulties in my own country. When I look only at that, then I worry. But when I look at the world, there are a lot of problems, even within the People's Republic of China. For example, the Hui Muslim community in China has a lot of problems and suffering. And then, outside China, there are many more problems and more suffering. When we see these things, we realize that not only do we suffer, but so do many of our human brothers and sisters. So when we look at the same event from a wider perspective, we will reduce the worrying and our own suffering."
I was struck by the simplicity and profundity of what the Dalai Lama was saying. This was far from "don't worry, be happy," as the popular Bobby McFerrin song says. This was not a denial of pain and suffering, but a shift in perspective, from oneself and toward others, from anguish to compassion, seeing that others are suffering as well. The remarkable thing about what the Dalai Lama was describing is that, as we recognize others' suffering and realize that we are not alone, our pain is lessened. Often we hear about another's tragedy, and it makes us feel better about our own situation. This is quite different from what the Dalai Lama was doing. He was not contrasting his situation with others, but uniting his situation with others, enlarging his identity, and seeing that he and the Tibetan people were not alone in their suffering. This recognition that we are all connected, whether Tibetan Buddhists or Hui Muslims, is the birth of empathy and compassion. I wondered how the Dalai Lama's ability to shift his perspective might relate to the adage, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. Was it truly possible to experience pain, whether the pain of an injury or an exile, without suffering? There is a sutta or teaching of the Buddha called the Salata Sutta that makes a similar distinction between our feelings of pain and the suffering that comes as a result of our response to the pain. When touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed, ordinary person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So he feels two pains, physical and mental. Just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterward were to shoot him with another one, so that he feels the pain of two arrows. It seems that the Dalai Lama was suggesting that by shifting our perspective to a broader, more compassionate one, we can avoid the worry and suffering that is the second arrow.
Then another thing. There are different aspects to any event. For example, we lost our own country and became refugees. But that same experience gave us new opportunities to see more things. For me, personally, I had more opportunities to meet with different people, different spiritual practitioners, like you, and also scientists. This new opportunity arrived because I became a refugee. If I remain in Potala in Lhasa, I would have stayed in what has often been described as a golden cage, the Lama, Holy Dalai Lama. So, personally, I prefer the last 5 decades of refugee life. It's more useful, more opportunity to learn, to experience life. Therefore, if you look from one angle, you feel, oh, how bad, how sad. But if you look from another angle at the same tragedy, that same event, you see that it gives me new opportunities. So, it's wonderful. That's the main reason that I am not sad and morose. There's a Tibetan saying, wherever you have friends, that's your country, and wherever you receive love, that's your home.
There was an audible gasp in the room at this poignant saying, and at its ability to ease, if not erase, the pain of a half century spent in exile.
Also, whoever gives you love, that's your parent. So, I consider you, although you are only 4 years older than me, as my father. I think you never could have had your children at the age of 4, so you are not my real father, but I do consider you as a father.
What you said is quite beautiful. I think I would just add to it by saying to our sisters and brothers out there, anguish and sadness in many ways are things that you cannot control. They happen. Supposing somebody hits you, the pain causes an anguish in you and an anger, and you may want to retaliate. But as you grow in the spiritual life, whether as a Buddhist or a Christian or any other tradition, you are able to accept anything that happens to you. You accept it not as the result of your being sinful, that you are blameworthy because of what has happened. It's part of the warp and woof of life. It's going to happen, whether you like it or not. There are going to be frustrations in life. The question is not, how do I escape? It is, how can I use this as something positive? Just as you, Your Holiness, have just described. Nothing, I think, can be more devastating in many ways than being turfed out of your own country. And a country is not just a country. I mean, it is part of you. You are part of it. in a way that is very difficult to describe to other people. By rights, the Dalai Lama should be a sourpuss.
The Dalai Lama asked Jinpa for a translation of sourpuss. The Archbishop decided to explain it himself.
It's when you do that face.
He was pointing at the Dalai Lama's quizzical expression and pursed lips, which did look a little like he had bitten into a lemon.
Just that face, just like that. You look like a real sourpuss.
The Dalai Lama was still trying to understand how one's puss could look sour, and Jinpa was still trying to translate.
And then when you smile, your face lights up. And it is because in a very large measure, you have transmuted what would have been totally negative. You've transmuted it into goodness. Because again, you have not said, well, how can I be happy? You've not said that. You've said, how can I help to spread compassion and love? And people everywhere in the world, even when they don't understand your English, they come and they fill stadiums. I'm not really jealous. I speak far better English than you, and I don't get so many people coming to hear me as they come to you. And you know what? I don't think they come to listen. They may be doing that a bit. What they've come for is that you embody something, which they feel. Because some of the things that you say, in a sense, are obvious. It is not the words. It's the spirit behind those words. It is when you sit and you tell people that suffering, frustration, are not the determinants of who we are. It is that we can use these things that are seemingly negative for a positive effect. And I hope we can convey to God's children out there how deeply they are loved, how deeply, deeply precious they are to this God. Even the despised refugee, whose name no one seems to know. I look frequently at pictures of people fleeing from violence, and there's so much of it. Look at the children. I say that God is crying, because that is not how God wanted us to live. But you see again, even in those circumstances, you have these people who come from other parts of the world to try to help to make things better. And through the tears, God begins to smile. And when God sees you and hears how you try to help God's children, God smiles.
The Archbishop was now beaming, and he whispered the word smile as if it were the holy name of God.
He wants to ask another question.
The Archbishop had noticed that I was leaning forward. It was extraordinary to hear how deeply they were engaging with joy and suffering, but at the rate we were going, we wouldn't get through one-tenth of the questions I needed to ask. The Dalai Lama slapped the Archbishop's hand.
We have several days, so it's